Jim Kawakami, the editor-in-chief of the very athletic Bay Area. Jim Kawakami.
Tim Kawakami, who's covered the NBA for over two decades, and more specifically the Golden State Warriors over the last 12 years.
This is the TK Show.
Hey, everybody. Tim Kawakami here, TK Show, recording from the home studio. This is like my first home studio recording for the TK Show in a while. I've had some kind of live guests. But here we are back, a normal show with an unnormal person as my guest. The one, the only ESPN's 49ers writer, reporter, whatever that is, insider, whatever you are, Nick Wagner. You're many things. Thank you so much for being on the show. How are you doing today?
Apparently, I'm an unnormal person. I didn't know that.
I didn't want to slag you off with all the others. Like you are, extraordinary. I should say extraordinary. You are rising to the top.
There we go. And exceedingly not even mediocre golfer would be another way to describe.
You are so. Getting there. You are improving. That's all I want to be. And you are dedicated, which I respect. You know that. I respect the dedication. I respect the
I wish I could play more. We need this contract stuff to get my biggest fear during all this is like accepting an invitation to go play golf and then being on like hole 13 as far away from the clubhouse as possible.
And
all of a sudden my phone starts blowing up. So
that has happened to me. That's the glory of being a columnist, is I can say, you know what, I'll get to it later. But it happens. The last time it happened to me, I was on, not with you, but I was on a course with someone else, and the Shohei Ohtani deal happened. And, you know, that's not a huge deal for the Bay Area, but it still was pretty large. And I'm like on the sixth hole going, oh, I kind of want to come back and go write that, but I'll think I'll just finish the round here.
Well. I think I was with you. We might have been playing Harding Park that day, I think.
No, it wasn't Harding. It was another, I remember, I just can picture the moment, and it was like another course. I can't remember where it was.
Might have been Half Moon Bay, too. I don't know.
I do think
I remember us talking about it because it was a big deal, obviously.
So. Yeah, and that's when we were launching the North and South podcast. So obviously Dylan Hernandez and I had been talking about it. So that was like, I got to get back and try to record this podcast fairly late, you know, and that he didn't sign with Giants, although that was pretty clear. Well, listen, you're not here to talk about these things. You're here to talk about 49ers. I just want to start this generally. You've been on the show many times, but haven't really asked you. 49ers are such a huge story nationally. We can feel that. We know that. But I think probably you can communicate this as someone who is reporting for ESPN. We know how much ESPN like concentrates on the 49ers. But do you feel that? Like, is there a sense of how big a draw the 49ers news and headlines are nationally? What's the ESPN pull to the 49ers?
Yeah, I definitely feel it. And I think it's been a long time since we saw like the numbers of like, you know, because everyone can personalize their ESPN app, right? So you go on your ESPN app, you personalize it. So these are the teams that you're following. And if you're following that team, you're getting all the notifications on that team. And I'm sure they still track it. I just haven't seen the numbers in a while on how many people follow the 49ers. And it was top five in the league, but it was also like, I think it was at one point 31 of the top 32 were all NFL teams. And the Warriors, I think, were the other one actually. and that was in the peak of their dynastic run there. But you definitely have that sense of like, hey, every time I'm writing something or every time I'm putting something out there, even people who aren't necessarily just visiting the website, which there are many, obviously, are getting a notification that they can just click one thing on their phone and they're reading your content. And I do think that just because in the NFL there are a handful of, you know, the gem franchises, right? The ones that are, you know, viewed as historically great, that people are always going to care about, good, bad, mediocre, whatever. I think the 49ers fall into that. And, you know, I can compare it because I covered the Rams for so long, and I covered the Rams for ESPN too, where it wasn't quite the same. Obviously, there was a lot of interest in a lot of things that were going on there, but not necessarily football related because they were so bad for so long too. And so, you know, Tim, I covered the league for 13 years, and actually before, longer than that, it was 17 years, I think, before I covered a team that had a winning record, which was the 2019 49ers. That's how, I mean, I started in like 2004 was my first year. The Rams were 8-8 that year. And then I didn't cover a winning team that actually had a winning record until 2019. So yeah, I feel it, especially feel it around the playoffs. You know, we have just the way we do things. It's not necessarily a normal beat. I'm not writing every single day. like a lot of, you know, newspaper writers and stuff like that. And we are thinking more nationally. I am thinking, what are bigger, deeply reported stories that we can get into? And especially in the playoffs, you'll see that for me every week, basically, there's that pressure that I've got to be building these big stories. And so the one good thing about the 49ers being good, and we know that they're good, is that I can plan those stories. I mean, I'm not joking or exaggerating when I say that here in August and in July, I'm already working on stories that will probably be in play down the line if they're in the playoffs. And so there is that kind of spotlight on them. And certainly with all the interest that they've drawn for the quarterback issues, and, you know, the head coach is very interesting. The GM is very interesting. I mean, I don't have to tell you and everyone listening, they know all the storylines and all the star power that is out here, but they definitely move the needle. There's no question.
Do you get calls from your bosses like on a Monday, we need something from you on Thursday, because this is just a hot thing going on?
Generally, they do a good job of trusting me. I would say, I appreciate that. I kind of have a sense for that. Now, there will be things that like this stuff, the IU stuff that's dragging out, and you know, there's a fine line between is this overkill, and are we giving non-update updates, or is there something that we can spin forward? And so, we do have those conversations of hey, is it time to circle back on the IU thing? Is it time to circle back on the Trent Williams thing or whatever? You know, but we generally try to always think when we're writing these things, spinning it forward as much as we can. Now, with something like this, you can't do that too much, because you don't know what's going to happen or how it's going to play out. But you try to lay out what, you know, talk to people and then lay out what the scenarios are that are most likely to happen. And so, those conversations happen. But for the most part, I think they trust me to, you know, have a good kind of handle on what needs to be written about and what's going on.
Well, let's get to Ayuk. Unlike my buddy Barros, you are actually leading me into Ayuk. He tries to push me away from talking about Ayuk, that little Barros. Let's just the general question. This people are asking me all the time, why is it taking so long? Why is this specific one? We know the Bosa one. Let's put that to the side. I just think that was one that they decided was going to be a different one. But why is Ayuk different than Debo, Warner, Kittle, Christian McCaffrey, whatever the ones we want to talk about? Why is this one seem so confusing, so contradictory at times? How do you kind of pinpoint how this has happened like this?
To me, there's two things, Tim. One is, I think that Brandon Ayuk is in a position where it's really hard to gauge exactly what his value is for the 49ers and from his side, because you could see both sides of the argument. From the 49ers side, it's okay. You had a really good year last year. You were second team all pro. You do all the things that we like you to do. But at the end of the day, you know, you still haven't had a 10 touchdown season. You haven't had more than 13. I think he had 1342 last year as his career high in yards, which is good, but not record breaking top of the market number. The Brandon Ayuk side of that is, well, yeah, that's true. But I'm also on a team that has this guy, this guy, this guy, and this guy. And if you were giving me those amount of targets and you were giving me those opportunities, my numbers would be up there with Justin Jefferson and CeeDee Lamb. And Brandon Ayuk could even theoretically make the argument that 3 years from now, he'll get that opportunity, depending on what the 49ers can do personnel-wise over the next few years. So I think it's a little bit of a tough spot, because the 49ers, I think, value Brandon Ayuk very highly, obviously, based on the offers that, you know, they've reportedly made. They do. Brandon Ayuk's argument is well, I would like to be valued like those other guys, because I would be putting up those numbers if I was in a different spot, or if I didn't have those other guys around me. And he can also say, isn't it more valuable to have somebody who is willing to make those sacrifices and still be an excellent run blocker, for example, and do all those things that make him such a good fit here in San Francisco? The other side of that I think is harder to quantify is, this feels, Tim, and I'm sure you would agree with me, like a way more emotional negotiation than any of the other ones. Even the Debo one never really felt this emotional. And I know Brandon Ayuk has, on multiple occasions, he's used social media. We've seen all that. Whatever he can to try to, as he's openly admitted on the Ryan Clark's podcast, apply pressure to the 49ers. And I think the 49ers try to be, as much as they can, in the past anyway, have tried to keep business, under wraps as much as they can. You know, with the Bosa thing last year, never any leaks of numbers, and that lasted forever, but there was never any risk. of anything, of losing him or trading him. That was never really in play. But even with the Debo thing, the Debo trade request, like, you know, he did the wipe his, you know, wipe the Niners off of his IG account or whatever, but he wasn't out there like posting videos of him and, you know, Ryan Tannehill. I was just trying to think of a South Carolina quarterback or someone, you know, like
that, wow, someone, that's, you know, a good pull of that.
You know, all right. Yeah. So, you know, something like that, where it wasn't like videos of that, like trying like, oh, I'm going to go play, you know? So I think that has played a part in this. And I think you've made the point, and I don't disagree with it, that the Niners got beat on the Nick Bosa extension. They had to basically give in to everything that they wanted. And I think they have tried in this case to dial it back, knowing that, yes, we value Brandon Ayuk very highly, but there's a difference between that and a guy like Nick Bosa, where he is just absolutely imperative to everything we do.
Yeah, clearly, you know, and you kind of get that empirically, but you can also understand Brandon Ayuk doesn't have to agree with that, right? He doesn't have to say, oh, yeah, Nick Bosa's over there and I'm over here. But it's been confusing. I think it's, you know, I've criticized the 49ers. I just think it's in their control. They're the team that's paying out the money. They should have read this. But I do think there's been some confusing signals from Ayuk. I think it's made it tougher, especially when the 49ers want to win this deal. Nick, do you think the 49ers can still win this deal? Like, whatever we say, whatever winning is, do you think it's more likely to fall on whatever side they want to be on, or is it more likely to fall on whatever side Ayuk wants to be on?
At this point, I think the only winners in the deal would be us, so we'd have to be stopped talking about it is if it gets done. I mean, honestly, like, I think it's such a narrow-minded way of looking at winning the deal, quote unquote, because if you sign a really good player and he's a really good player for you and he makes a bunch of money, everybody wins, right? To me, the only way that either side loses this deal is if the Niners have to trade him for draft picks and don't get anything that helped them this year. Like, that is an unmitigated disaster for you, both from a short-term and a long-term perspective. I've been banging this drum for a while that the 49ers are in a position here where, yes, they need Brandon Ayuk for 2024 and trying to win a Super Bowl. Of course, we know that. You take away their most productive receiver, they're going to have trouble doing that this year. But also, this is about kind of transitioning into that next nucleus of stars that's supposed to, quote-unquote, keep the window open. And if I'm looking at their roster right now, I see Nick Bosa, I see Fred Warner, I see Brock Purdy, I see Brandon Ayuk as like kind of the four guys that, if you're asking me who are going to be the guys they're building around in 2027, let's say, those would be the first four that I would mention. And maybe Christian McCaffrey, if he, you know, proves to be as bionic as maybe they think he is. But I think it's about both short and the long term. So to me, if a deal gets done, Brandon Ayuk stays. Let's say that by the time his big salary cap numbers kick in a couple of years, he's going to be, what, Tim, the eighth or ninth highest paid receiver?
Maybe.
Isn't that about right? Yeah. I mean, isn't that, right? Like, that's probably about what it would be, depending on, you know, Jamar Chase. You got all these other guys who are going to get paid too. And so, like, looking at it just through the scope of, like, well, I don't know if we should pay him like a top five receiver. Okay, should you have paid Jimmy Garoppolo like a top one quarterback? No, but that was the going right. That was what you had to do in that moment. And then very quickly, he fell out of that position to the point where he was probably appropriately paid by the time his big salary cap numbers kicked in. So to me, the real winners in a deal, Tim, if the Niners and Brandon Ayuk get one done, are logic and common sense, because it just makes too much sense for these two sides. They should stay together, because I do think the Niners are better with Brandon Ayuk and they know it. Ayuk is better with the Niners and he knows it.
If the NFL network reporting is true, which I certainly believe is, forget it was Pelissero or Garofalo or it was somebody. So Garofalo is ESPN, my bad. That they're basically have like really close, and now it's about the fourth year guarantees. And you know, that plays right into my theme song, that it's not about the cap, it's about guaranteed money. And this is about the 49ers trying to limit the dollars they're committing to someone 4 years down the road. And that's the issue, right? It's like, is he going to be worth this in 4 years? And as you say, the cap goes up. Other receivers are going to jump. Garrett Wilson, like, we got all these younger receivers that are going to jump.
Absolutely. Forward.
Like, this is happening. There are always guys who are going to jump up the cap, the salaries for top wide receivers. And if this is about how much money they're committing, guaranteed money they're committing, I don't know why Brandon Ayuk's the one where you draw the line. Debo Samuel, I understood. A player who gets hurt, a player who plays in a physical way, isn't a classic receiver, certainly not a split end like Ayuk is. physical, blocking, all those things. That one I understood. There are other players I can understand. I would even sort of understand Christian McCaffrey because he's a running back now. He's, you know, got the calf injury. I would still pay him. Obviously, he's so good. But I would get like, okay, wait a minute. Are we really going to commit this money down the road to a player we're not sure is going to maintain his value? I don't know another player on this roster other than Bosa and probably Purdy who I'm sure I could feel good about committing guaranteed money 4 years down the road other than Brandon Ayuk. Nick, am I wrong here, or was this a sense of that you have too?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I think the one thing that we don't know is you know, if Brandon Ayuk is looking for guarantees in year four, is he wanting those guarantees now at the time of signing? Because that would be unusual.
Yep.
You don't see a lot of players, non-quarterbacks anyway, who get guarantees beyond the first 3 years of their deal. Now, if it's a discussion of, well, there's going to be guarantees that kick in for year four at the end of year two or at the end of year three, that may be it seems like a small thing, but that may be something that is holding this back, or the Niners are okay with doing that, but they would like to not have that guarantee kick in until after year three, where they could reassess if they need to, if something goes wrong with this contract. But if he wants to get paid, you know, hey, I want at least the chunk of my base salary in year four guaranteed. I could see why the Niners might balk at that, because it's just something that doesn't happen a lot. But I'll also take you back just to walk down memory lane real quick. The 49ers, for a long period of time, when they would do these long-term contracts, they would put in the option guarantees, right? So at a certain date, the next year, a part of the next year's salary, or all the next year's salary, whatever it was, or even an option bonus would kick in. It used to always be like April 1st of that following year, April 15th or something like that, of the year going into the next season where that would kick in. George Kittle changed the game on that. When they did the George Kittle deal, that was the first time that they kind of caved in on like, hey, we're going to start guaranteeing these a year in advance. And so sometimes you just have to change. And I would make this argument. The 49ers, with the exception of the Harbaugh years, they didn't have a lot of star players, Tim. Like this is not a ownership group and leadership group that is used to paying top players at their position league-wide. You know, it's one thing to do an extension with Navarro Bowman, who's got 2 years left on his deal, when you're a bad team and you don't really have a lot of other guys to pay. It's another thing altogether when you've got guys who are demanding – and deserve top of the market contracts at their positions. And so I do think that has kind of forced the 49ers into a position where they're doing deals or pieces of the deal that they didn't do in the past and they didn't necessarily want to do. But I think it's just got to be their reality, because it's a good problem to have, because they are legitimately good players and the types of guys you want to pay, rather than just keeping a bunch of guys who aren't that good just because they're the best on your team. That's a good thing, but it does make it more complicated, and I think it has probably kind of had to take a while for them to kind of adapt to that new reality.
Obviously, I think we know there's a Brock Purdy contract coming down the road. Do you imagine, are they looking at a potential, like, could this be a fight with Purdy in the next year's camp? You think the IU contract situation is a sign for Purdy? I don't think so, just because quarterback's a different thing. But maybe, I don't know, what do you foresee for the way that one might go?
I tend to agree with you, and I also tend to think the 49ers will have as much urgency about quarterback as possible, because that is one where you definitely want to get it done before the next quarterback gets paid as much as you can. And I mean, especially in that case where it's like, you know, what if Dak Prescott is a free agent? Like Dak Prescott, if he is an unrestricted free agent and they can't tag him and he hits the market, I mean, the numbers he could do could be something that would really blow up the quarterback market. And Brock Purdy might have an argument to be in that range. So I would think they would want to do it and want to play ball. But that conversation is fascinating, because it is so much of the argument could be Brock Purdy, again, he needs us as much as we need him. And he's never going to find a better situation than this. This is where he's going to have the most success. He's welcome to go try elsewhere. I don't think they would do that, but I'm just saying, when they're doing the calculus in their head of what they're trying to offer him, I could understand why they would go that way. And then his argument would be, well, like, I've done everything you've asked me to do, and above and beyond, I've been better than any quarterback you've had in the Shanahan era. I've also been, you know, drastically underpaid this entire time. You need to make that up to me. You got to make me whole somehow. So I don't know that it's going to be easy in the sense of a big deal like this is always going to be difficult, especially when it comes to a quarterback. But this one in particular, it's hard to know because this is a big moment for both the team and the player. And there's so many different arguments that either side could make to try to keep the price down and also to push the price high.
You know, if they don't sign Brock Purdy, they can always trade 3 first round picks, move up in draft, and for sure get a franchise quarterback. Like, we know they can. They're proven to do that.
Well, they could take the quarterback and then the following year use the last pick in the draft on the 7th rounder to be the guy. So that's the pattern that they've established.
Yeah, that's the thing I get. Like, people say, you know what? They got him in the late round. They're going to do it again. No. That one might be the once in a lifetime draft pick, and you cannot count on doing that again. I am pretty sure you cannot count on doing that again. Let's go quick. Trent Williams. I mean, I think we've all got the sense that this – I mean, Kyle certainly seems confident that they can get this done. I know he's been right and wrong. He thought they could do Bosa right within a couple of weeks, and it took him all the way to the first week of the regular season. Trent, any potential, you know, danger signs with that one?
I don't see it. I think that I'm of the belief, I've said this multiple times now, many times, that I don't think Trent minds not being around for this part of the season, particularly at this point in his career, and the fact that he's been deep into postseasons each of the last few years. I think that has taken its toll on him, and so I think that is a part of this conversation. I will say, and I've said this also multiple times, I think that if you're looking at the discussion with Trent Williams' contract, it's a little bit more difficult than the McCaffrey one. It's a similar setup, right? The idea is they didn't have any guarantees left, and McCaffrey didn't have any running backs that really surpassed him, but still they wanted to, you know, at least artificially bump up what his annual average salary is and for running backs. And so I think with Trent Williams, it's a little different just because of the age. You just don't – like if we're talking about – like we were talking about with Ayuk, like how many years are you guaranteeing money? And if you're going to give him a signing bonus that's going to put future more money into future guarantees, that then becomes a little bit more difficult because you don't know how much longer he's going to play. And in Trent's case, he's already got, you know, void years and things like that because they've restructured him a few times where there's already money – that's stretched out here. So if they add to that, then you start thinking, well, what if in 3 years he's retired and we've got $25 million in dead money on Trent Williams? Maybe they just have to eat that so that they can make the run. That's a possibility. And I'm sure they would like to do it that way so that they could lower the cap this year and then roll it over to offset some of that. But I do think that is probably the hardest part of all this, but I have a hard time seeing a scenario in which he's not on the roster and starting a left tackle on Monday night against the Jets.
I think the only scenario I see, logical one, is he's really playing great, some great golf in Houston right now, and he just doesn't want to pick up the ball because he can't play when he's during the season. So that might be it. I would understand that part.
That's true, but he should be out here if he wants to golf. You know, the weather, the Houston weather at this time of year has got to be abysmal. I mean, it's just like a swamp down there right now.
It's okay if you're used to it, Nick. It's okay if you're used to it. You just get it out.
Fair enough. I used to be used to it too, but I lost that. I lost that ability when I moved out here.
You've gotten soft like all of us West Coasters, and I.
Yeah, admittedly.
Let's get to camp. I'm sorry, we went on and on this. We do have to address the signing stuff, but. Nick Wagner, you are an astute observer of practice. You've been at every single one. Your Twitter breakdowns, I like count on them. They're fantastic on every. This is a new thing. It's fantastic information. I look at it like the practices I've been at. Like, did I see it correctly? Let's see what Nick said. Okay, all these practices, you've gone through it analytically. You're charting everything. Who would be like your standouts? Who would be like, let's do this. Like, who would be your MVPs this training camp?
The two that jump out to me the most, Diamador Lenore at cornerback and Deebo Samuel. And for similar but different reasons, the Lenore, who I just wrote about the other day, I had a really good conversation with him last week. We talked for a while and just kind of about where he's at, how he got to this point. You know, he kind of filled me in on how he's kind of become a film junkie, and that's really helped elevate his game to another level, and how he basically, you know, like there's all these contract discussions and superstars and like, he seems like he's just fine. Like, I'm going to play this out and bet on myself because he's been healthy and he can contribute and he's in line for a big deal. But he's just so consistent. I think every day he makes a play of some kind that makes you kind of say, wow, that was a heck of a play. He's super competitive. He's always out there. He's not taking the vet days like other guys are, which I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I'm just saying that's a you know, something that's notable when you're watching him. He just looks like a guy who is ready to take that leap into that kind of echelon of 49ers stars. And Charvarius Ward did it last year, right? Like, Ward was always a really good player, but last year he started getting those picks and it took him into another level where he's a Pro Bowler and an All-Pro. And I think Lenore has an opportunity to do that. And the thing about him, of course, is he's doing it at two positions, which makes it even more impressive. So he's certainly one. Debo, to me, is he has that look in his eye like he had in 2021, which I think we would all agree was his best year and maybe the best year by any, 49er we've seen, at least skill position-wise, in terms of just putting a team on his back toward the end of that year. But he came in great shape, first of all. Okay, that's part of the deal. Like, that's for him a big step forward. But I think there's a couple of things that are driving him right now. Number one, I think he takes these losses really hard. These end of the year, the tough losses in the playoffs. I mean, we've seen him emotional on the sidelines after games and things like that. So I think that's part of it. Number two, he's not in a contract year, but he's in a contract year. Let's just call it what it is. Like, that is the reality of Debo's situation, where depending especially on what happens with Ayuk, he could be looking for, and I guess I would say either way, he's probably looking for his next contract after this year, even though he has 1 year left on the deal. Technically, if he has a huge year, and that's the other part of this, Tim, not to go back into the Ayuk stuff too much, but if they don't sign Ayuk or whatever, if let's say they did trade him and Debo goes and has a great year, they're going to be back in the same situation next year with Debo Samuel. So I just want to point that out in the midst of this conversation. But the fact that he's been out there a tone setter almost every single day, I think he's taken maybe two vet days, but he was the last of the vets, like the star vets, to do that. I think he's taking it very seriously. And even his teammates will tell you, both on and off the record, like, this is the Debo that we think can really get us, kind of help push us over the hump, because this is the guy we saw a few years ago.
Oh, it's interesting, when they're in team drills, ones versus ones, guess who's guarding Debo? Mostly D'Amador Lenore. It's real. That's been a prime matchup, and I agree with you on both. And they, the 49ers offense needed a standout guy to be practicing every day. They haven't had some of their second, third, and fourth line guys practicing, busting his ass out there, when we know sometimes he hasn't in past years. So that for sure. And Lenore just looks fantastic. I think the secondary, Nick, best 49ers secondary.
Yeah, I think there's a real chance that this will be the first, since they got good, so since 2019, this will be the first Niners defense where the secondary is better than the pass rush. I think there's a real chance that that happens. Now, I still have some questions at safety. I think Jair Brown had a really good camp also. I would put him maybe just a notch kind of below D'Amador Lenore, just because he doesn't have quite the experience, but he's looked a lot better, looks a lot more confident and comfortable being where he's supposed to be. We still need to see how Hufanga comes back from the injury, but I think at corner, they're a lot better. Isaac Yiadom, before he got hurt, looked good. I think they're still kind of counting on him. But Renardo Green has at least shown the ability that he can be their fourth corner, and it's really nice if your fourth corner is a guy who can play inside or out. He's very competitive. He's a little handsy, so I'm curious to see how he gets officiated when he gets into regular season games. But in terms of competitiveness and coverage ability, he's right there, and he's willing to stick his nose in there. So, yeah. I think they have a chance to be really good on the back end. They're definitely the best corner pairing that they've had under Kyle Shanahan and John Lynch. It's just, to me, I mentioned the pass rush. I just have questions. I just don't think it's as, every year it's usually they're keeping 9 or 10 defensive linemen, and you're scratching your head on, like, they're still going to cut guys that are good players, right? Like, they usually have a lot. I just don't see that. I see 7 guys that I think they feel pretty comfortable with, and an 8th who maybe fits in there. But if they keep 9 or 10, it's just because that's what they traditionally do, in my opinion, not because they're part of the 53 best guys. So I think their starting front four has a chance to be really good, but some of the waves and the depth and the things like that they've had in the past, that remains to be seen to me. So if that secondary is as good as they hope it can be, maybe that can offset some things, and they can make a few more plays on the back end.
Okay, quick, let's give me one maybe disappointment. Who would be your disappointment in this camp?
Ooh. Ricky Pearsall, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, I hate to put that on a rookie, but just the fact that he hasn't been out there, especially given the opportunities that are there. You know, Ayuk obviously hasn't been around. Juwan Jennings has been banged up off and on there. You know, Debo has been the mainstay, but there is ample opportunity for Ricky Pearsall to go in there and say, hey, like, maybe you don't need to pay Brandon Ayuk. You know, that has been there, but he just hasn't been able to stay on the field. And neither one of them has had a huge amount of snaps. But I could argue right now that Jacob Cowling in just the last week did more than Ricky Pearsall was able to at any point. And again, that's not a commentary on Pearsall's ability to play, because I do think he, you know, at least when we've seen him on practice, there's been signs of what the Niners like about him, but we just haven't seen it. Otherwise, as a disappointment, I would say, I probably just go back to that defensive line situation. I just think that, you know, they sacrificed Eric Armstead, which I understood. You can't pay that much money to someone who's not on the field at this point in his career as much. And they went with quantity to replace him, which, again, I also understood. I just don't know. I just don't know if they're going to be good enough and if they're going to be able to stop the run as well without Eric Armstead and with the guys that they have and the depth that they have. And I would say also, Tim, just looking at the depth as a whole, I think this is the most top heavy the 49ers have been since they got good. I just, you know, in recent years when they make these cuts, there's four, five, six guys that either get claimed or, you know, are guys that people are interested in, might make a trade for. I don't know that that's going to happen this year. I think there's maybe one or two guys at most that would be those kinds of candidates, depending on what they do. But I just don't see that type of depth that they've had, other than at corner, which, you know, ironically has been a weak point for them in recent years. I think it's probably their deepest position, other than running back and receiver, if everyone's available, that we sit here right now. So
yeah, I just think, yeah, it's a little bit of, you know, there'll be a price for trading all those first round picks for Trey Lance, yep, and then Lance not coming through. So you basically have, you know, almost a full generation, you know, 3-4 years in the NFL is a full generation where they don't have first round picks, so they can just plug in. Now, Ricky Pearsall is one of them, their first one in a while, and he hasn't plugged into anything. But I understood the trade. There would be a cost to it. They got as lucky as you possibly can get by having Brock Purdy drop in there. But you're still, there's a cost. All right, we're taking plenty of time.
Oh, and they gave up a bunch of picks for McCaffrey, too. Yeah, yep. That's I mean, you know, it wasn't first round. It was obviously a great trade. I'm just saying that's where you feel it. That's where the trade-off is. It's great that you have Christian McCaffrey. You would never take that back. But that depth where you lose all those first-rounders and you lose a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, you know, those types of things can add up when you're talking about down the roster. And they had a lot of injury luck last year, Tim. So if they don't have that this year, that could really put them in a dangerous spot.
Already banged up. As always, good stuff. Good point on McCaffrey. I'm glad you added that. All right, let's finish this up with a version of a question I've asked you before. I ask all my guests, except for Brock Purdy and I guess a few other. Jim Harbaugh didn't ask this because we're kind of rushed there. But we're getting back to it right here. Nick Wagner, what's your favorite TV show right now?
I don't watch a ton of TV, but over the summer, my girlfriend and I, we caught up on Only Murders in the Building, which I had not seen yet. It was one of those that everyone was talking about it and everyone else I knew had seen it and was pushing me to see, which usually, Tim, this won't surprise you at all. Usually when I'm not in on the ground floor or something and people try to like peer pressure me into doing things, that makes me more adamant about not doing that thing.
Shocking.
Generally. Shocking. Yeah, I know. I'm sure you're stunned by that. But in this case, we dove in and we just finished up season 3. I think the fourth season is coming out here soon. I enjoy it. As someone who grew up with like my parents, especially loving like Steve Martin and Martin Short and like that, like genre and era of comedians. It's kind of fun to see them do their thing. And I will say the one thing that show does unbelievably well is cameos. Like the people they get to be on that show is unbelievable. And I'm sure it's because of Martin Short and Steve Martin and Selena Gomez, where they have this kind of gravitational pull. But by season 3, when you've got Meryl Streep, one of the greatest actors of all time, playing a significant role, it kind of tells you how far along they've come. So looking forward to that next season. I haven't watched Receiver yet. Yeah. I like to save some of those shows for long plane rides, which I know I will have plenty of coming this season. So I'm sure I will knock that out and probably have opinions on it at some point in, say, October or November.
Now, I only watched the first episode, but that was a 49er heavy episode. And I just, like, I didn't really want to watch all the other stuff and all the other receivers. But first episode was pretty good. I told Kittle, like, it was a good episode because he has the birthday surprise birthday party and there's Nick Bosa there. He's like, Bosa's here. Oh my God. Like, I was just surprised. What else is Bosa doing there? He doesn't leave his house during the season. So, right. Just
the only thing more surprising would be Jimmy Garoppolo sending him a birthday text.
That would be impossible. Yeah, I just to Jimmy, he just got back to me. That would be impossible. We'd know that was made of it. All right, Nick. Appreciate it as always. Great conversation. Let's get on the golf course. But of course, you're too busy, and I'm just trying to hit the ball as far as I can.
I'm just trying to hit the ball, period. But I haven't played since camp started. That's what the Niners are doing to me right now. I need them to do this for the sake of my sputtering golf game, if nothing
else. We will say the greatest time we had, we go out to Baylin's. Nick and I were the twosome, and the two singles that join us include was one Paul Holland, great VC guy. We just met him. He's become a friend of you and me. We've played with him since. Great guy. And then someone else joins at the very end, drives up, and we're like, that kind of looks like Jerry Rice. And it was indeed Jerry Rice who played nine holes with us and was great. It was great to play with. So I don't know what happened.
So much fun to play with.
Yeah, I don't know what happened to him, like, but he was really fun to play with. Like, he was fun. He was pulling for all of us, hitting our balls. You know, he was looking for golf balls. I still say, I don't want to demean you, but he was looking for your ball on one of those holes. Yeah. And I really give him credit for that. Like, he was helping out, and it was really fun to play.
It was, and the only he would have played, you know, so people know we play. He only played nine, but he would have played 18, I'm sure. But we were that was a slow day. I think it took us over 3 hours to get through nine, and so Jerry, understandably a busy man, had to move on. So I didn't blame him for that also, and probably he was tired of helping me look for my ball.
I really appreciated that he was doing that. I just thought it was cool because you hook up with other people on the golf course, or even people you're playing with, and they're not helping you, and Jerry was out there helping. It was cool. All right, absolutely. Nick, really appreciate the time. I'm sure I will see you soon, and. We will. I guess they're gonna. Is it still gonna be open practices next week for the media? I didn't think so.
It sounds like one more week. Wow. It sounds like that's what they're gonna do.
That means they don't want to open up the locker rooms with that.
That's exactly what it means. So I guess if they do it like last year, I think that means it'll be one more day with the full 90 on Monday, or maybe not the full 90, but because I said last year, I was like, oh, they'll make all their cuts before they practice again because they don't want to risk an injury, having to do an injury set on that guy. And then they still practiced with 80 something, and then they made their cuts the next day. So if they do it like last year, it'll be one of those, and then they'll switch to the 53, and then my big walls of Twitter text will go away for a while. So.
Those are great. Nick, I keep going. Those are great. I really like them. All right.
Well, everybody. It's better than doing it in the, I used to do it threaded because I couldn't do it the big one long text. And so at least it's nice to have it all in one place. And it helps me too because I've already filled up two full notebooks during this camp. So that's kind of a way of just like, hey, I emptied my notebook. And if I need to go back and look at stuff, I can do it that way.
More Nick Wagner long tweets. I like them. All right, Nick. Appreciate it so much. Thanks. Talk to you soon.
You got it.
All right. Show for day, everybody.